We are going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 today. That's where we left off last time. And this is a chapter, really chapters 5 and 6 are both this way. They sound a lot like Proverbs when you're reading them. They're going to just have different topics that are going to come up, just like you would have in wisdom literature, different topics that are very practical. But mainly with Ecclesiastes, what we're getting is a change of perspective. What you think about certain things in life needs to change. That's what's going on in this book. We have to get from the point of saying everything is futile to everything is beneficial, or at least the things that are gifts from God we can appreciate and enjoy. And this is a transition chapter, these two chapters, actually, 5 and 6. 7 is going to be a highlight. It's going to be kind of a climactic point. But we're going to start moving, actually dealing with money here and riches, wealth, which is a common theme that we have in the book of Proverbs. It's also a common theme that you have in Jesus' teachings as well. A lot of people think the Bible is impractical in so many ways. A lot of times, I guess, they just don't read it or pay much attention. They think it's such an ancient book. How does it apply to me? But when you look at the topics that are dealt with, they're the same topics that people deal with today. And all of us have known those who are obsessed with money, obsessed with wealth, and those who are obsessed with the fact that they don't have any. That's another issue. But that is part of life. And we need to recognize that our theology needs to be very practical. God is interested in every aspect of our lives, not just in the time that we worship Him. In the ancient world, the common understanding for gods and goddesses was all you need to do is go worship at their temple and appease them, and then they will be nice to you. Or at least, if they're not nice, they at least will leave you alone and not hurt you in any way. But as far as any concern of a god or a goddess for your life, or whether you are enjoying life, or whether things are going well, they don't care. Everything was selfishly motivated with them. And so even for those in Israel, they had to change their perspective on what gods and goddesses are to the one true God and how He is. Because all of us, in fact, I'll be teaching this week at the college, we're starting this week, and an Old Testament survey, we're going to be in the Job through Malachi section for this semester. And one of the points that I like to make, since we're also going to be in Ecclesiastes for at least part of the time, is that we need these texts to continue to remind ourselves that God is not to be in our image. We need to be in His. Mm-hmm. That it is very easy for us to make God into what we want Him to be. And I'll call Job through Malachi the uncomfortable part of the Bible. But it's the part that makes God very real. Because last semester I told them, when we were in Genesis through Esther, in the story, I said you'll see the whole story because we go all the way through the story right up to the end of the exile. But you're going to see it more from a distance. That is, you'll see people interacting with the Lord, and you'll see others, you know, and how they interact with the people. But now, in this section of Scripture, poetry forces you to become very internal. You actually will have more emotion, you'll have more connection, I guess, to your own attitude about God in these texts. So Ecclesiastes is part of this process. It's actually designed to help us get out of our minds what other people think about God, or what we think about God if we were to create Him in our own image. It's to show us what He is really like. And we need that reminder. That's why we need to be in the text over and over. Well, we're going to start in verse 10 of chapter 5, and this is going to be the perspective on money. And my plan is actually to get into chapter 6 a little bit today, because if we just ended in chapter 5, it's going to be more on the negative side, whereas when we get to chapter 6, at the very end of 5, it turns a little positive. But it's going to be one of those cases of there is a wrong way to view this subject, and there's a right way to view this subject. If you have a relationship with the Lord, if you know Him personally, then there is a wrong way and a right way to think about money and wealth. Let me give you this background before we get into this, because this is not a denunciation of having money or having wealth. That would go against all of those passages in Scripture in the Old Testament where God promised that to people who were faithful to Him. You know, He promises that through the covenant, that you will have land, you will have, you know, your houses will be full of things. He actually promises that to His people. And so when they are faithful to Him, the expectation is that He will bless them. So realize this is not going to say, oh no, He didn't mean that, or oh no, you're not supposed to have those things. In fact, that's why I want to get into chapter 6, because it gives us the perspective that wealth is a gift from God as well. So anyway, let's look at the first three verses here, verses 10 through 12. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. So there are some practical illustrations there, I guess. But we'll start with the first part, and of course you know the New Testament also verifies this as well, or at least repeats it, and that is the love of money. Money itself is not the issue, it's the love of money, the desire for it. And this is very much what he says earlier about wisdom. Those who love wisdom and desire wisdom, in and of itself, wisdom is not going to be fulfilling. It has to have that connection with the Lord. It has to be a gift from Him. And we need to recognize it as that gift. But someone who loves money is never satisfied. I think it was John D. Rockefeller who was interviewed one time, and he was asked, you know, how much more do you need? How much more would you like? Or how much more do you need besides what you have? And he said, $1 more. And now, John D. Rockefeller actually was very giving in his church and all that kind of thing, but at the same time, he still had that mentality of, it's not enough. Whenever we have that idea, it doesn't matter what part of life we're talking about. It doesn't even matter if it's just money. But I don't have enough. I'm not satisfied with what I have. That's where we have the wrong perspective on things. And I know that's difficult, but my plan is, I think I've told all of you this, my plan is when we finish Ecclesiastes to go right into the New Testament in the book of Philippians. Because I think Philippians has the same message as Ecclesiastes, just in a different way. But if Paul can be chained in a Roman prison and say, I'm content, then our understanding of contentment has to be revised, because it's not a matter of our circumstances that brings contentment. And I know that sounds an awful lot like power of positive thinking, or that you can think your way into enjoying something. Paul never, I'm sure, enjoyed being in prison. That it's not a matter of enjoying it or thinking that it's a good thing. But it is the idea that you know that if God is truly in control of our lives, and that our benefit is ultimately what He is interested in, then whatever state we're in, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, is still part of His overall plan. And trusting Him, that's the That's the hard part. That's why this semester starting in Job is always fun, because we deal with, you know, what is it like to be content in a time of suffering? Or how does suffering fit into God's plan and purpose and all of that? And I usually answer with I don't give them answers to a lot of the questions, because I don't have them myself in terms of why. Although in Job's case, we're told why. But anyhow, this says, those who love money and those who love abundance are never satisfied. But then in verse 11, when good things increase, those who consume them increase. That's an interesting economic principle there. We used to have this thing back in the 80s they called supply-side economics. You know, you just supply it and people will use it. You know, if you make enough of it, people will use it. Now, that doesn't work with every product, let me say. Yeah, that doesn't always work. But in this particular case, the point is that even when you have more things, there will be more consumption. In other words, those things disappear. The more stuff, the more consumption. And especially when someone is in the state of verse 10 where they love money or they love things. They're never satisfied with what they have, and it seems like the more they have, the more they use or get rid of, or, I don't know, consuming, I guess, would be the word. I also think this might be in connection, because you have to realize this is an agrarian society. We're talking about crops and things of that nature, that if there's an overabundance of those things in a society, you wind up with gluttons. You wind up with those who get way too much. You know, it's the difference between taking someone to a restaurant where they must order off a menu versus taking them to an all-you-can-eat buffet. Okay, do you really think there's a lot of control? Some people might be disciplined, but for the most part, you know, the more stuff, the more consumption takes place. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The owners would be those who are producing the things, I think the producers at this point. Then verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. That sounds like a working man who is satisfied. That's the idea there. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Now that has a very practical significance, and that is eating late at night, filling your stomach, and then trying to sleep. But also, it goes back as a metaphor to the more you have, the less satisfied you are. The less you have, it's strange, the less you have, the more satisfied you can be. With fewer things, not with more things. That's a complete reversal. I find that some of these well-known financial planners and those who are the spokespersons for, you know, how to handle your money and that, they've come up with this principle, whether they're not getting it from Scripture, but just from observation, that, you know, less is actually better than more. I think there was something on Twitter that I saw with CNBC. There was a someone who was very wealthy, you know, I think in the billions, and he said, you know, he's an older gentleman, but he said, you know, young people today should be satisfied with $70,000 a year. Of course, that's quite a bit for some, but, you know, should be satisfied with that and not trying to make hundreds of thousands of dollars every year, because the more you make, the more frustrated you're going to be with what to do with it and how to use it and all of that. And so that was his advice. Now, that doesn't mean he's giving up his billions, but it does mean that he recognizes there's something in that. So that's just practical advice. Now, verse 13, there is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. This is the hoarding of riches. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. And I think the him there is the son. Now, again, this is incredibly practical, but the issue is the hoarding of wealth, which stems from the love of money. That is, the hoarding and the love, they go together. That this is a very specific situation. There's a bad investment, and he has a son, and then because of the bad investment, he has nothing. So it's like losing it all. It's like betting it all on one thing. Because that's the attitude that people have. If they have money, first of all, here's the real problem in the attitude, and that is if you think that you are the one brilliant enough to have the money, that is, you're the smart one, you're the one who really knows, and that's why you have all that money, then that leads to the recklessness of making stupid mistakes. If you recognize that what you have comes from the Lord, and it's actually His money, and you just have it, you're going to treat that money a lot differently. All right? So let me go to verse 15. This is probably one of the best statements throughout the book, but it's also in other places in Scripture, including Genesis. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. What's the old joke? You'll never see a hearse with a U-Haul behind it. This also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. What is it? You came into the world with nothing, you're leaving with nothing. You're not going to be taking anything with you into the afterlife. Now, that's actually for those who are in Israel, they know there are cultures around them that do believe you can take it with you. In fact, even some of the cultures in the Canaanites, we've found some of their graves where they would have all kinds of stuff piled in with the body. Now, whether that was piled in because they had a connection to those items, but the thing is, in some cases, they were like food items and things that you wouldn't normally put in a grave. The Egyptians were the best at it, though, because they had elaborate ways of taking things with them in the way that they buried their dead. One thing that has been traditional among Jewish graves is just how empty they are. That if they truly are practicing this, they generally are the simplest of graves, because the idea is, well, first of all, that person is not there anymore, and secondly, nothing you put in there is going with them. I mean, once you seal that tomb, it's not as if all that stuff just floats into some other place. So this is just a practical statement. And then at the end of verse 16, so what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? That is a summary question that could be made all through this book. Because what is toiling for the wind? What is chasing after the wind? Well, pretty much everything. Anything that you can think of where you are pursuing it for its own end is a chasing after the wind. Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. So that's the person who loves money, who hoards wealth, and who thinks that they can take it with them, I guess, or that somehow it's better for them in the future. That sounds like a life of misery right there. So verse 18, here is what I have seen to be good and fitting. Now we get the positive. If that's the negative, let's look at the positive. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. I really like that whole verse because it pulls a lot of strands together. We've had snippets of this all the way through up to this chapter, but this one pulls it all together. What is the best thing you can do in terms of your perspective in life and how you live your life It is to enjoy yourself in the labor that you are doing, in the work that you're doing. And that's very important that it's in all one's labor rather than just eat, drink, and be merry and don't work. You know, that's the laziness we've already hit earlier. We did that earlier, and that's not a positive thing either. But in the work that you have to do, enjoy the work that you're doing. I know that is so much easier said than done in the real world. And they had the same problem. Trust me, they had many a case. We have laws in Israel that are very clear about this, of oppressive owners and oppressive people that others are working for. That definitely is true. That's just as true in the ancient world as it would be today, because sin is still there. But the idea is, if you want your ideal perspective, it's that life is meant to be enjoyed. And notice, it's a few years, which those of us, as we get older, we realize what that means. And then, that God has given him a gift from God. Seeing when something is actually a gift. I have something in my own experience that I try to remind myself certain times, especially when I'm having one of those really difficult days when I go into work, which probably will start tomorrow since school starts, where all these things hit you at once, the pressure of work, the pressure of other people who are also pressured by work all around you, everything hitting at once. And I think back on the first job that I ever had, which was a bit odd. I was 14. It was a friend of my parents that they were in the same church youth group together when they were kids. And this friend owned a bicycle store. And at 14, I was not looking for a job at all. I wasn't planning to work at that age. In fact, I kind of enjoyed the fact that I could go with our youth group and do all sorts of things on the weekends. And well, somehow through my parents, I think it was an arranged setting, kind of like people have arranged marriages. Mine was more of an arranged job. It was like, yeah, sure, he wants to work. It's like, all right. So I got a job between junior high and high school. It was in that time period. I had to get the work permit, all that. Well, I knew nothing about bicycles other than riding one. That was the only thing. And of course, they did repairs. They had the full retail, you know, selling them. And here I am, a 14-year-old kid who shows up. And it was a family-run business, so they had trained their own kids to, you know, do all of the things. First task I was given was, there's a bucket there, and there's a brush, and they have these big picture windows out front of the store where everything's on display. Go and wash the windows. All right, so 14 years old, I'm putting the stuff in, washing the windows outside. All right, finished that. That was not a whole day's work, okay? Go back in, and it was funny because the woman who, you know, was a couple who owned the place, and she said, oh, you're finished already. Okay, well, then there's a sweeper here. I want you to go around and sweep, you know, everything, and make sure you get in the corners and all that. Well, in a bicycle store, you got things like grease, you've got all kinds of dirt, but that place was spotless when I went in. And so I did all that, took maybe a couple hours, maybe it was lunchtime by then. And then after lunch, it's like, okay, I'm finished. Well, you only did the front. There's a whole back to the store too, you know, where they're doing all the repair work and all. That's where the real grease is. So I did that. I just remember the first week of work was just that kind of stuff. But weirdly enough, that wasn't a time in my life when, through church and through the Lord getting a hold of my life, I started developing a real relationship with the Lord at that time. And so church was actually enjoyable to go to, listening to sermons for the first time, really, and paying attention. And then going to work where I'm doing all of these like menial tasks. But thinking back now, I remember very vividly, probably 2 or 3 weeks into doing all of that, how much joy I started getting from cleaning things. It's very odd because I would never have done that at home, certainly not my room. But just knowing that I'm doing something and I could be praying, I could be in my head singing songs of, you know, spiritual songs and all of that, and knowing the Lord has a connection in this and cleaning dirt, cleaning things, actually was enjoyable. And I have to say, in all honesty, that that was probably the most enjoyable time I had in that job. I worked in that job for 14 years, all the way through college. But they trained me how to repair bikes. They trained me how to sell them, which I didn't like doing too much. But they trained me on all of that. And I did all of those things. But there were times when I longed for going back to give me that sweeper and I'll sweep. Actually, they hired some other younger kids and they started doing it, and I actually envied them. But I was getting paid too much for that at that point, so they didn't want me to do any of that. But I just thought, okay, that's a principle, and that's not knowing Ecclesiastes. I didn't know Ecclesiastes very well, but I just thought, that's a time in my life when I can say I truly enjoyed it. But everyone else would be looking at that saying, you enjoyed washing windows, you enjoyed sweeping. Yes, there was some secret that I had learned. I'll say that it's the Paul secret of being content, but secret of enjoying life and enjoying work, even though it was something that, you know, most people wouldn't want to do. So that's how I think of this, all right? I know that was a long illustration, but that's how I think of this, is the time when I know I had those moments when this was in practice. And I'm guessing that all of you have had moments similar to that. Maybe not cleaning, but something where it's like, this work that I'm doing actually is enjoyable, but it's not just enjoyable because it brings pleasure for its own sake, but it's because I feel like I have a purpose, I have a part. There's something in my identity and in my purpose that's connected to this and connected to the Lord. And I can actually rejoice in the Lord for what He has given me to do. And we have to think back on how God created man to begin with and what was His task that He gave him. There's a garden that I have placed you in. Work that garden, which means it needs to be worked. But also it means you need to do all of the things to help those things grow and develop, and the animals and caring for them, all of that, that is your task. And that would be an enjoyable task until someone comes along and says, is this all you're about? Is this really all that you should be doing? You could be like him. You know, I almost want to think, and I know this would be reading into the text, but it'd be like the serpent catching Eve one day when she's doing some work in the garden and saying, you don't have to do that. There's no need for you to do that. You could be like him and he doesn't have to work at all. Obviously, we know that's not true either. I know I'm reading into it. I'm just thinking in terms of the way this book is arranged, that's how we think of work. Do everything we can to get out of it, not to get into it. And yet this is saying, no, it is those tasks that give us not only purpose, but that is our reward in this life. This is how we can enjoy life. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, He has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Now, there's your positive perspective on money. If you want the positive perspective, it is whatever God gives you. Well, first of all, whatever money you have, whatever wealth you have, And trust me, all of us would be counted as incredibly wealthy to many people in the world. Actually, having going on mission trips to third world countries will clue you in on that very quickly. And it's like we have all of these things, but how much of that do we recognize is God's gift to us? And how much of it is do we truly enjoy as his gift to us? And that's the perspective. Verse 20, for he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. You know, this is, the second time, maybe the third, but for sure the second, because chapter 3, I recall the other one, where God keeps people occupied. You want to know what God's will for us is? Keeping us occupied. Keeping us focused on the task at hand, so that we don't think about all of the things that are negative, such as the years of our life. Oh no, I'm a year older. Oh no, I'm 10 years older. Oh no, I'm 20 years older. You know, thinking back. You know, there are times, all of you probably experienced this, when time off from work is not a good thing. Because that's when we sit back and we think. Now, sometimes, yes, you can think back over, you know, if we do it the way that God showed us how to do it, you think back over the things that you've accomplished over your 6 days, and your seventh day becomes the day when you rejoice in what has been accomplished. But how we use our seventh day often is, oh no, I'm getting older. Oh no, I'm not going anywhere. Oh no, I've hit the end of whatever it is, and look, there aren't very many years left. And then it just becomes the turmoil of I'm not enjoying anything. God has given to us work to keep us occupied so that we will rejoice and enjoy life. That's a whole different perspective on work than most people think. I see this on all kinds of things right now. I don't know what the point of this is, because I'm not sure why, but I have seen at least a couple of dozen of articles from different reports, different news media, about people who are 30 years old and retiring. I don't know what the deal with this is and what it's trying to promote, okay? It's like, here's someone who lived frugally for these years, saved up a bunch of money, and now they're retiring. Usually it's a couple, you know. They're retiring now at 30. And it's like, well, good for them, but at the same time, what are they going to do with their life? You know, if you retire at 30, even if you retire at 40, you still have strength of body, you still have that. What are you going to do, you know? Get a yacht, wander all over the place. I mean, it's actually, according to this, would be a rather miserable existence if you didn't have anything to look forward to, anything to do.
All of your friends are working.
That's true. All your friends are working. And do you think your friends are going to be that friendly anymore once you're the one that doesn't have to do anything anymore? So I've just seen dozens of articles like this. And I guess it's the idea of trying to show people that it can be done, even in our situation today, that people can actually, you know, build up enough money that they need, and then it's done. That seems to be their purpose. Well, and God gave him the kind of dominion where he could name the animals, and trust me, once he's named the animals, they become a part of his world, and so any care for them is also something that would be enjoyable. Yeah, no, the curse was not work. People think that. They think, oh, God cursed man with work. No, no, no. He did not curse man with work. The curse comes from the toil that comes from work, but that is an act of grace, I still say. It's an act of grace to show us things are not the way they ought to be. He's given us pain and toil and suffering through that curse, that specific curse. Pain in childbirth, pain in work, you know, all of the pain that comes that he has cursed us with in the very areas where he has given us purpose and identity. All of the things that he has told us to do, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion, but everything's going to fight against you. That tells me that in order for me to fulfill my purpose, there will be pain in that process. But if God did not give us the pain and the suffering in the process of doing those things, we would go on our merry way and never seek him out at all and never think that anything's wrong. He's actually, the withholding of things is an act of grace to show us that we need to be closer to him. Because it's not true joy, if this book is correct, it will not be joyful for us to just have everything that we want and to just live life with that and no work. That's not joy. There's no joy in that. But to recognize God's part in our lives in giving us the things that he has given us, and then to do it for his honor and his glory, that's a whole different perspective. So that's where the perspective shift comes. And I think this book is not necessarily, I did say earlier that this book could be an evangelistic book. It could, people who've lived this part of life and they realize the pain and the suffering and all the things that go with it, it can function as an evangelistic tool, drawing them to the Lord. I know many people who've had that experience with this book. But it also is for those who have been with the Lord for a long time. That is part of the community, part of being a Christian, part of being a believer, even a faithful follower of him, but not having the right perspective on life. This is to give us that perspective so we can understand he really wants us to enjoy these things. I want to go on into chapter 6, just in this first part, because I think it connects with what we've just had, and it's a little more positive as well, although it starts with the negative again. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. That means you won't have to look hard to find it. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. That is all the work that you've poured into it. But God, and keep God in the picture here, because the text does. God has not given them that ability to enjoy the labor that they've had because someone else has come and taken it. That's the opposite of what God has done earlier, because in verse 19, if you go back there, he has also empowered him to eat from them and receive his reward. That is to enjoy the fruit of one's labor. That's the other side. Now, you might say, well, how do you determine whether it's going to be one or the other? Well, you don't. God does, ultimately, of when that's going to happen. But it's apparently a common thing because he said this is prevalent. Verse 3, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, I don't know how 100 children would, but anyway, however many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say better the miscarriage than he. I'm always bothered by the neuter pronoun here, because miscarriage is a human, but I don't say, actually, you know what, I'm in NASB. Let me go back to ESV. I don't know what they are doing. I didn't realize I was in New American Standard. Not that there's anything wrong. Yeah, sorry about that. I had switched apparently at some point and didn't realize it. Okay, ESV, verse 3. If a man fathers 100 children, lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. Well, they're doing the same thing. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. That's a very depressing passage, thinking of a miscarried child. But at the same time, it's just what was said earlier, that there are circumstances in life where a person who does not enjoy life and is actually vexed by all the evil and the horrors around them, it is better that they had not been born than they see these things and experience these things. It's no different from that. But in this case, it's a little different in that that example was about all of the horrors and really the sin and the evil around us. This is not about the sin and the evil around us. It's about not enjoying life. So it's stepping it up a notch, you might say, because it's one thing to say, okay, if we've experienced evil around us, it's better for someone who's never been born and never experienced that. But this one is different. It's here's someone who has not enjoyed life, lived a miserable life. Not talking about the evil and the oppression, just not enjoying life. Someone who is miscarried is better than the person who lives the miserable life, because at least there's rest. That sounds depressing, it sounds horrible, but at the same time, the point is, that's how bad life is for someone who just does not appreciate God's part in it and the gift that he's given us. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest. Well, I already said that. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place. Doesn't matter how long you live. Please put that in the same context with the one earlier who was considering their life in the sense of how long or how short it is. If you had another 100 years, if you had another 1,000, if you had 3,000 years, can you imagine living 3,000 years on this planet? Yeah. Well, in any case, no, it's still bad because there's no enjoyment. If it would be that enjoyment, like Adam experienced, then make it multiple thousands of years. We'll enjoy every one of them. So verse 7, all the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. It's almost like we're coming back to that money thing again. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool, and what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. So, seeing is not the problem, it's our desire that's the problem, which comes from the lack of satisfaction, the lack of contentment, never being satisfied, not waking up in the morning and thinking, oh, I've got to get more of whatever, but waking up realizing, look at what I have. Don't we have that? We have a couple versions of a song called Count Your Blessings. We have one that's more of a hymn version. We have a Bing Crosby version, but Irving Berlin. But either way, what's the point? It's to see what you have rather than paying attention to what you don't have. It's just common sense, but sadly, that sense isn't all that common, because what's more prevalent for people to be discontent? That's why I really do want to go through Philippians when we're done with this, because Paul's secret is this secret. It is to learn how to be satisfied and content with life in whatever state we're in. And as I said, if Paul can say it when he's in a prison, I think most of us can say that. All of us could say it in our context. So, this is the perspective. what we have, the good things that we have, the things that we tend to desire and that other people desire, are the things that God has given to us. Not so that we can worry and fret about those things, but that so that we can enjoy them as his gifts to us. Which means recreation is okay. An overabundance of recreation to the point where you don't work anymore is not so okay. But yet enjoying what we have. I still think the principle that God gave us in creation of the one in six is still a good balance. 6 days of work, 1 day not just sleeping or resting, but the day of looking back and saying, that was good. It is good. Isn't that what he said? In fact, he even said it's very good. And if God can do that, and he has no needs, by the way, he has none. He doesn't need to do that. I made that point, strangely enough, it wound up in one of our promotional things. A student that was in my class last semester in Genesis, we were talking, and I said, God has no need. Why did God create mankind? And the answer is, he wanted to. It's not that he needed it. Anyone who tells you he needed love. He has a trinity, okay, the three in one. They have perfection of love within the person of God. Within the being of God, there are those persons. There's perfection of love. He didn't need love. He wasn't lonely. There's nothing in God that necessitated our creation. He wanted us. That's why he created. And so I focused my attention on the fact that he wanted us. It's a desire in him. It's not a need, it's not a necessity, and there's no obligation on God's part for us to be here, except that he wanted us. Now, from that point, we need to start and find out what he wants in us. But as far as he wanted us, you are wanted. And I had many in the class starting to cry during that one, because I emphasized the point of those who are orphans or those who've come from families where they feel like they're not wanted. And I said, there's one thing obvious. If you're here, God wants you, for sure. I didn't get into all the Calvinist stuff of elect and non-elect, because that's not the point for that. The issue is, you are wanted. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. And so the things that he has given to us to do is not because he needs us to do those things. He's giving them as gifts for us. God can do all of these things himself perfectly fine without our help. I always thought that with evangelism. I thought, you know, Lord, you could actually do a much better job than any of us could ever do with that. But he wants us to be a part of it because he wants us to experience the joy of the results of that. The same is true with work.